Happy Monday, happy November, belated happy Halloween, happy All Saints Day, happy whatever, from the Religious Studies Project. My name's Christopher Cotter.
My name's David Robertson.
We are the Religious Studies Project, brought to you in association with the British Association for the Study of Religions. And as we're into November, I can already hear Santa's bells jingling in the distance, and I thought it was time to flag up that our Amazon links before we get into the interview. So if you are in the US, UK, or Canada currently, if you go onto our website, we've got links to amazon.com.co.uk and .ca, and if you buy your Christmas gifts using those links, it won't cost you any extra, but we make a significant percentage on that, and you'll be supporting the project. But with that appeal...
With that appeal, we have a gift for you. And this week, it's our interview with Peter Harrison, and it's on the subject of science and religion in Europe, a historical perspective.
And which is actually what he did his Gifford lectures on in Edinburgh a couple of years ago.
So over to Jack Zonis for that.
Today, the words science and religion conjure images of two fundamentally distinct domains of knowledge, with science, or more properly, scientific understandings of nature, generally held to be inimical to traditional religious understandings of history and traditional religious conceptions of the human person. Indeed, the ferocity of this debate is one of the defining features of contemporary Euro-American intellectual discourse, particularly at the public level. However, this division is very much a recent one in the longer context of European history. And in fact, most of the great investigators of nature in the early modern period understood themselves as engaged, somehow or other, in deeply religious work. What, then, was the relationship between naturalistic study and theological commitment in the early modern period? How has this changed? And what can an understanding of this history tell us about contemporary debates? Today it is my great pleasure to be discussing these questions with Professor Peter Harrison, one of the world's leading authorities on early modern European intellectual history and the history of science, particularly regarding the interface of science and religion. Peter Harrison was formerly the Idrios Professor of Science and Religion at Oxford University and director of the Ian Ramsey Centre there, where he continues to hold a senior research fellowship. Since 2011, he has been director of the Centre for the History of European Discourses at the University of Queensland, where we are sitting today. He has been a visiting fellow at Oxford, Yale and Princeton, and is a founding member of the International Society for Science and Religion, and a fellow of the Australian Academy of the Humanities. And in 2011, he delivered the Gifford Lectures at the University of Edinburgh. His five books include, most recently, Wrestling with Nature, From Omens to Science, an edited collection which surveys conceptions of science from antiquity to the present, published by Chicago in 2011, The Cambridge Companion to Science and Religion, another edited collection published by Cambridge, 2010. The Fall of Man and the Foundations of Science, published by Cambridge, 2007. And The Bible, Protestantism and the Rise of Natural Science, published by Cambridge a decade earlier in 1998. So, without further ado, Peter Harrison, thank you for talking to the Religious Studies Project. So, Peter, in the introduction to the Cambridge Companion to Science and Religion, you described that the contemporary perception of a sort of perennial contest between science and religion is simply not borne out by the historical record. And, in fact, you say, and I'm quoting a small section of the book here, insofar as there is any general trend, it is that for much of the time, religion has facilitated scientific endeavour and has done so in various ways. Thus, religious ideas inform and underpin scientific investigation. Those pursuing science were often motivated by religious impulses. Religious institutions frequently turn out to have been chief sources of support for the scientific enterprise, and, in its infancy, science established itself by appealing to religious values. Now, this is, of course, a sort of a counterintuitive position given the contemporary nature of what people understand with science and religion. So, could you talk about how that actually played out in the early modern period? How did what we call science grow out of religious impulses?
Sure. Well, look, I think, first of all, there's an important general question that we need to think about, and that is, why does science arise when it does and where it does? Which is to say, why is it that science arises in the West, and crucially, why is science consolidated in the West?
Hmm.
That is to say, we do see scientific activity in other cultures, but what we tend to see there is a boom-bust pattern, that we see sporadic instances of science developing, but it doesn't seem to consolidate in the way that it does in the West.
And by that you mean sort of the scientific method, sort of experimental investigation of nature, those kind of things?
I mean those kinds of things, but I mean those kinds of things being developed and consolidated, becoming a central feature of the culture.
Mm-hmm.
And that happens uniquely in the West.
Mm-hmm. And what time?
And that happens at the time that we typically call the scientific revolution. That's when it starts.
Yep.
And so the general question that historians grapple with is, why?
Mm.
What's distinctive about Western culture that leads to this kind of, not merely scientific discovery, but a consolidation of scientific discovery and a moving of scientific activity right into the centre of...
Institutionalisation of it.
Precisely, it's institutionalisation. So if you look around this university, you see something quite remarkable compared to universities in the 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th, and even up to the 19th century, and that is that a huge amount of this university campus is devoted to science and technology.
Hmm.
And that's a very distinctive development. So one of the questions is, could it be the religious culture of the time? And as you've said, one of the standard answers to why science arises in the West is that it arises because there's a breaking away from religion. Now, actually, the historiography of the most recent 20 years suggests that it's the opposite, that it's the specific religious values of the West that underpin science in various ways, that in its infancy give it legitimacy, that provide motivation for key players, and that also underpin the assumptions that make science possible and the methods, the unique experimental methods that we see emerging in the 17th century that drive those methods as well.
And can you perhaps then speak a little bit more to the specifics of the religious ideas motivating this, providing that sort of seabed? For example, in The Fall of Man and the Foundations of Science, you talk about, for example, Francis Bacon and how he was a very clear-cut example of the idea that the investigative, inductive method was designed to repair the damage done by the fall. By, you know, Adam was regarded as the original encyclopedist.
Yes. All right. Well, part of what justifies the pursuit of science is the values that underpin it. All right. And so we tend now to think about science as kind of self-justifying. It's justified in terms of the great technological benefits that it gives rise to. But in its infancy, that was simply not the case. Science did not have the practical outlays that we see today. And indeed, many critics of the early Royal Society, which was founded in 1660, said, what is the use of all of these activities that you guys are engaged in?
Hmm.
And one of the answers was that these things are of profound religious importance, that scientific investigation helps establish the orderly nature of the universe and gives us evidence of the power and wisdom of God. Now, that idea has been known for a long time, but there are other really crucial elements of what Francis Bacon, who was a key inaugurator of a new scientific method.
And he was writing in the 1610s,
1610 to 1620 are his most influential works about this. And he tells this very interesting narrative about how when God created Adam and Eve, Adam had a perfect knowledge of nature. But then with the fall and Adam and Eve's expulsion from the Garden of Eden, they lost this universal knowledge of nature. Now, says Bacon, what religion does for us is it helps put us back in touch with God. But the sciences, he said, they help us re-establish the knowledge and power over nature that we had once enjoyed. So the motivation to know nature, but not merely to know nature, to have dominion over it, to control it, to get technology from it, these things for Bacon, and indeed for the scientific project in the 17th century, are motivated by this religious idea that part of the redemptive process is not merely to do with morality and religion, but with a re-establishment of our power over nature that we had once enjoyed.
And although there's also sort of a tension in that, although they were, as you say, sort of aiming for mastery, there was, as you talk about a lot in the book, a very strong, elegant element of Augustinian sort of anthropology behind all of this, which emphasised the depravity of man and therefore the limitations on what could be achieved.
Sure. So there are two elements to the, there are two elements actually to this story of the fall and how it motivates science. And one is this very general idea that we once had this mastery over nature, it was lost, and it can, to some extent, can be re-established. Then there's the question of the means by which this is possible. And here again, Francis Bacon, indeed all of the key figures in natural science in the 17th century, are characterised by their rejection of the scientific tradition that had come before, and that was a scientific tradition that was based on the ideas of Aristotle, and Aristotle had the view that human minds are naturally aligned with how the natural world is. And as a consequence of that, all of Aristotelian science was grounded on fairly uncritical general observations about how nature operates in its normal course. So to take a simple example, we know that when we observe them, feathers fall to the ground much more slowly than lead weights. And so based on that simple observation, Aristotle has this theory about heavy objects falling faster than light objects. Now, early modern science overturns that assumption, and they do it by establishing observations under strict experimental conditions. But the religious idea that motivates this is, yes, our minds once were aligned with how nature is, but as a consequence of the fall, they are no longer. So our minds don't give us easy knowledge of how nature works. It follows that it's going to be very hard to understand the operations of nature, and we will never grasp them fully. So the new experimental approach to nature is this deeply sceptical view about the powers of human reason, and it, what it suggests is that we need an experimental approach that in some respect is counterintuitive. We examine nature under strict experimental conditions. We do this numerous times. We need to observe nature up close. We need lots of people doing it. We need special experimental conditions to do it with, and if we do that, in the long term, we will accumulate gradually the kind of knowledge that will help us re-establish this power over the natural world. And so this basic idea that when human beings fell, they not merely lost their moral capacity, they also lost some of their intellectual capacities. This was quite foreign to the Greek tradition of Aristotle, but it was embedded in this Augustinian tradition, which in the 17th century is revived, and it feeds into this fairly sceptical epistemology, that is to say, a sceptical theory of knowledge, that then gives rise to this probabilistic, cumulative, corporate approach to the natural world that that characterises modern science.
Yeah, it is quite remarkable just how sort of religiously motivated that enterprise was, given the sort of contemporary understanding of this sort of contest between science and religion. Could you perhaps, before we move on, we want to go through the Enlightenment and some of the subsequent history as well, but one of the sort of terms that was really common around this time was the distinction between the book of scripture and the book of nature. How, what was the relationship between those two concepts? And again, what does that sort of tell us about the religiously infused ethos of science in this period?
Well, the basic assumption of this two books metaphor, which goes right back to the Church Fathers, we find it in Augustine, for example, is that God is the author both of nature and of the book of Scripture, and that on this assumption there can be no conflict between the two books, as it as it were. Now, one of the interesting things, I think, is that the meanings of the metaphor shift. Galileo famously says, for example, that the book of nature is written in the language of mathematics. And this is quite an interesting shift because, again, if we think back to what Aristotle thought about mathematics, his approach was that mathematics gives us models of how we can understand the appearances of things, but mathematical understanding of, say, astronomy
doesn't necessarily give us the true causal account of how things work. And so mathematics was quite separate from physics in the medieval period. So when Galileo makes the claim that maths is written in mathematical language, and when someone like Johannes Kepler also says that God actually uses mathematics to structure the nature of the world, this brings about a significant change in the way in which the book of nature is read, and it brings mathematics and physics together in quite an unprecedented way. And we see that quite clearly in Galileo and its culmination in Newton's great work, the Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy. And there's, in fact, there's one more element to this, and that's an idea of laws of nature. Because up until the 17th century, the idea about the regularities of nature was that they were to do with the particular essences of individual things. Now, in the 17th century, we get, in the French philosopher Descartes, the idea that God has imposed laws on the natural world, and so the order is not immanent in nature, but it's actually imposed on it by God. And this then becomes a key presupposition for a new kind of mathematical science, where we can use mathematics to discover laws of nature, and laws of nature are understood as what God has promulgated for the natural world.
Yeah, so again, we see the very kind of religiously infused ethos behind all of this. So quickly, coming back to Galileo, could you maybe give us a brief comment on the church's reaction to Galileo, in the sense that, again, we the kind of bastardized version of the story today is that the church was kind of suppressing the progress of knowledge, but obviously that wasn't quite the case.
Okay. I mean, clearly, there is no doubt that Galileo had significant problems with the Inquisition, to understate it somewhat. And the Inquisition take an interest in Galileo on two occasions. In 1616, where he's forbidden to teach the Copernican view about the sun, the earth moving around the sun, and not vice versa. And then the more famous trial in 1632 that culminates in Galileo being condemned for suspicion of heresy. And he's placed under house imprisonment. So, now this episode, as you rightly say, has kind of become emblematic for the idea that science and religion are engaged in a perennial battle. So, let's not contest those basic historical facts, but here are two questions we need to ask ourselves. First of all, was this famous clash about science and religion? And the second thing we need to ask is, was this a typical instance? Was this instance indeed emblematic? Now, the answer to the first question is, in a sense, no, it wasn't. Because what you have when Galileo appears on the scene is a competition between two competing scientific theories. Or if we include Tycho Brahe, there are three competing models. One where the Earth goes around the Sun, one where the Sun goes around the Earth, and then a compromise position by Tycho Brahe. In terms of their predictability, these three models give you precisely the same thing. The advantage of the Copernican system was that it was simpler, but the scientific community had not bought into that. So that when Galileo proposes the Copernican model, there are fewer than 10 people in Europe who would have supported him. So in supporting the Copernican view, the church was not going against the scientific consensus. And it was compounded by the fact that Galileo had arguments for a sun-centred cosmos, a sun-centred solar system that didn't work, an argument from the tides that didn't work. The other thing, he didn't have the observational evidence, say, of the relative movement of the stars. If the Earth was moving, the relative position should change because of parallax. They don't. We don't see that until the 19th century. So not merely was there were there competing scientific theories, not merely was there not a scientific consensus in favour of Galileo's position, but there was even evidence against it. So in answer to the first part of that question, it wasn't simply science and religion. Was a discussion between science, and the church backed what turned out to be the wrong view.
But it was backing consensus science, not arguing against science per se.
Indeed. And the second point is, was this typical? And the answer is no. In fact, the Catholic Church was no other institution supported astronomy to the extent that the Catholic Church did between the 12th century and the 18th century.
Yeah, sort of a forgotten fact in today's debates.
Indeed. So, no denying Galileo has trouble with the Inquisition.
Sure.
Is it about science and religion? Well, not really.
Yeah.
Is it typical? Certainly not.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what then happens when we come to Newton? Because he's another person who, in the contemporary imagination, is sort of emblematic of naturalistic science, yet of course he was also involved in a whole bunch of alchemical speculation and a bunch of other things that we would regard as very unscientific today. So he's kind of an interesting hinge point.
He certainly is. I mean, Newton, as one historian has put it, was a kind of theologian who wrote a couple of works that turned out to be very important in the sphere of science.
Yeah.
But what we know is he wrote much more on biblical interpretation and theology.
Mm.
He has a number of alchemical transcriptions as well.
Mm.
So he's clearly an interesting figure.
Mm.
But Newton is, you know, you'd almost he's a thoroughly religious individual.
Mm.
He was indeed formally, in a sense, heretical, that he didn't subscribe to the standard view of the Trinity.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason he didn't was that he didn't think that doctrine could be found in the Bible.
Mm.
So he was very much a biblicist.
Mm-hmm.
But Newton famously, in a number of passages in the Queries in the Optics and in the Scholium at the end of his most famous book, the Principia, makes clear reference to the fact that his scientific theory points us in the direction of God.
Mm-hmm.
I think the interesting story is what happens after Newton, particularly in France, where Newton does not have a mechanical explanation for gravity. And in essence, what Newton's view seems to be, and certainly this is what his spokesperson Samuel Clarke says explicitly, is that gravity is the continual activity of God in the universe.
Mm.
That seems to be the Newtonian position.
Mm.
But what happens in France is that when Newtonianism is accepted there, it's taken as something that works as an explanation without any kind of theological framing that it originally had. So, in a sense, the theological scaffolding and assumptions that are deeply embedded in the Newtonian system are simply dispensed with in subsequent centuries, the assumption being that laws of nature are themselves, in a way, self-explanatory, right?
Mm.
For Newton, for Descartes, for Robert Boyle, for the key figures of the scientific revolution, this was not the case. The laws of nature were quite explicitly laws promulgated by God.
And, okay, well then that's a good point for us to keep pushing things forward after Newton. So could you perhaps talk us through the 18th and 19th century, perhaps up to Darwin, because that's obviously a big shift, even though he, you know, there was a lot of stuff brewing before Darwin. But what's happening in the 18th and 19th century?
Okay, the pattern is somewhat different in England, and say France is an interesting contrast case. In France, what happens is that science tends to be appropriated in ways that will pit it against ecclesiastical authority and religion. In England, it was exactly the opposite, that science underpins the religious establishment and it's used to underpin fundamental religious claims. Now, when Darwin comes along in 1859 with Origin of Species, obviously there are some problems.
Mm.
But again, just as in the case of Galileo, the case of Darwin is also quite complicated in terms of religious reactions to Darwin. Mm. There are religious opponents to Darwinianism, but there are also scientific objections.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the most famous scientific objections came from Lord Kelvin, who was the leading physicist at the time, who said, based on my calculations, there simply is not time for evolution to have taken place.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a serious problem for Darwin. Mm-hmm. As it turned out, Lord Kelvin was wrong.
How long did Kelvin think the world had been around?
The calculations were somewhere between 20 million and 400 million. It's a fairly wide margin of
error. Yeah, this is the point where the parameters of sacred history had sort of been exploded, but we hadn't yet got into billions of years.
That's right. So we have geological time.
Yeah.
But according to Lord Kelvin, and who was based this on the cooling of the Earth and various temperatures, he hadn't taken into consideration radioactivity, which was why his calculations were wrong. But even at the long end of his estimations,
you didn't have enough
time. So the point here again is that Darwinism, to some extent, is a little bit controversial scientifically as well as problematic religiously. So there is a discussion going on in the sciences about the legitimacy of the method.
Yeah. And, of course, he had significant religious support.
Mm.
Most notably, Asa Gray, who's the professor of botany at Harvard,
yeah.
but also much support from within the Church of England
mm.
as well.
Mm. But I suppose, though, it does sort of set the stage for particularly the 20th century and the division between a sort of a stridently naturalistic view and then and a more conventional theological view of humanity and history.
Yes, I think what you say is that Darwin then gets appropriated
yep.
for a particular purpose. Not a purpose that Darwin himself had in mind,
mm-hmm.
but you see this as early as Thomas Henry Huxley, who mm. wants to use Darwinism as a way of undermining the authority of the clergy and the stranglehold that they have on the academic institutions mm. In the United Kingdom.
Yeah, they called him Darwin's bulldog, didn't
exactly.
they?
Exactly, Darwin's bulldog, and then Richard Dawkins, of course, is Darwin's Rottweiler. That's the lineage. But so Darwinism does become appropriated for this battle, and of course this is made much easier by the fact that we get a new phenomenon in the 20th century emerging, which is scientific creationism.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an old tradition, it's a very new tradition, but it's the idea that we have a young Earth, an Earth that's only 6,000 years old, and this is argued on the basis of putatively the teaching of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a sense the conflict is fueled from both sides. You have religious fundamentalists and scientific fundamentalists, both of whom have a similar view about how science and religion relate. That is to say, a view that they're in conflict.
Mm-hmm. And what about, I mean, we're kind of getting into the contemporary period now. How have you seen this unfolding, say, since the middle of the 20th century onwards, when, you know, we had the secularization thesis dominating large swathes of Western thought, and only recently the whole, you know, post-secular kind of idea coming through? So what's been happening, again, from your perspective, with the distinction between religious and science in the last, say, 70 years, perhaps? 50 to 70 years.
Sure. Look, I mean, to go back to the secularisation thesis, I think in say, the 1960s, there was a widespread assumption that secularisation was happening all over the place
mm.
and that the demise of religion was inevitable.
Mm.
Now what we see is that that's just not the case. And this is a cause for considerable concern for many people, and in particular if you look at the idea that militant Islam is going to be the problem of the 21st century. And what this has done is to motivate critics of religion who see Islam as somehow Islam and Christian fundamentalism generally, as typifying religion.
Mm.
This motivates them to attempt to use science as the silver bullet that mm. will destroy religion by showing that it's false, it's wish fulfillment, etc., mm-hmm. etc.
And in doing so, they sort of deploy the kind of false narrative of science and religion as these kind of perennial enemies, which is we've been sort of unpacking over this discussion.
That's exactly right. And there's a very interesting story of the way in which when people like Huxley first wanted to use evolution as a weapon to destroy the institutional social power of religion, which you may be sympathetic to, but at any rate, when he decides to do that, part of the way this is done is that a story is invented
mm.
about this perennial battle, mm. and it supposedly goes right back to the Greeks.
Mm.
And we see this, for example, in Tyndall's famous Belfast Address, where he invents this history about how the Greeks kind of broke away from myth and superstition, but mm. then Christianity appeared and that got knocked on the head, and we're now trying to re-establish that kind of thing. Present-day versions of that thesis try and enroll the Enlightenment. They say, well, here's the key breaking point, and mm. we want to be true to the spirit of the Enlightenment mm-hmm. and reason, banishing superstition and ignorance. And
taking God out of Descartes.
Precisely, and a completely false view of the Enlightenment, and one that actually buys into the propaganda of a very small number of French philosophers in the 18th century,
mm-hmm.
But certainly not true to the historical record.
Mm.
And so, to a large degree, this contemporary idea about science being the enemy of religion and perhaps the tool by which we can destroy its power draws on
this false and invented history about a necessary conflict between these two entities.
Yeah, it is a really fascinating perspective, because I've got just a couple of sort of closing questions, and one of them was about your perspectives on not just the New Atheists themselves, the four sort of, Dedett, Harris, Dawkins and Hitchens, but just the rise of that form of atheism more generally. But in a sense, you've just sort of responded to it by saying that, one of the key things we have to bear in mind is that they're operating with a really fictionalized version of what scientific inquiry has been all about.
I think not only that, also a completely false view of what religion is about. And this means not merely a kind of artificial reifying of religion, that is to say, making religion into an object that somehow fits the varieties of, from radical extreme Islam across the board to Buddhism. So there's a conception of religion. Richard Dawkins will say on a number of occasions that religion and science compete for the same explanatory territory.
Mm.
They're trying to do the same thing. He says religion offers hypotheses about the natural world, and therefore, because science does the same thing, the conflict is inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
So part of what fuels their conception of a conflict is a totally false idea that religion really is simply trying to explain precisely the same things that science does. They don't seem to understand that religion is to do with values, to do with questions of meaning, and it's not simply attempting to give us causal explanations for, how life got to be here, how the cosmos got to be
made. Yeah, I've always regarded Dawkins as a world-class biologist and an undergraduate atheist.
Well,
to put it sort of pithily.
That's pithy. I think it's generous to say he's a world-class scientist because, in fact, he's published very little in science.
Mm.
The science that he has represented in, say, The Selfish Gene is extremely dated.
Mm-hmm.
It's a genetically based, it emphasises natural selection to the nth degree. So even in the scientific realm, the kinds of claims that Richard Dawkins made when he was writing popular science and not simply attacking religion, the science itself is dated. So his scientific credentials, I think, are actually not quite what people often assume.
Mm. Interesting. Well, maybe a final question then, and going back to what you were just saying before about religion and values and those kind of things, as opposed to simply being, an explanatory model. I'm interested in the sort of, homologies, the similarities between people who adopt a naturalistic, secularized worldview, whether it's of the new atheist variety or something a bit more nuanced or but still largely non-theological. I'm interested in how you see, again, just from your perspective, looking for, this long history between science and religion, at the naturalistic ideologies and the extent to which they resemble traditional religious ideologies. And the thing that's actually made me think of this is looking over at your bookshelf there and Mary Midgley's book, Evolution as a Religion, I've always thought was a really fascinating work.
There's an interesting history of science attempting to ape some of the forms of religion. The most obvious example of this is Auguste Comte's Religion of Humanity, where he had a very interesting insight that human beings need ritual, they need things that are going to give them meaning. So he tried to come up with a sign. He had a calendar of saints there, of scientists and so on. So he tried to have direct parallels in this Religion of Humanity to religion. Thomas Henry Huxley, who we've talked about, Darwin's bulldog, also talked about science in using ecclesiastical models. So he talked about lay sermons, that they were his kind of scientific accounts.
Mm.
And he realised that some of the religious institutions were important. But I think insofar as we get an attempt to create an alternative mythology, then again, it's not, so that if we think about the basis for a conflict between science and religion, one is if religion tries to come up with scientific theories, and scientific creationism is a good example of that, or even intelligent design is an example, but where they attempt to compete directly with science on its own territory, and they're going to lose. Okay, but when science attempts to compete with religion on its own territory, when it attempts to construct values, and to think about the new atheist, and where Sam Harris has written a book about how you might get moral values out of neuroscience, now, it's a completely fallacious argument, in my view. It's laughably crude philosophically, but clearly there's a realization that there is a need to answer the kinds of questions that historically religions have answered, and these are to do with questions of value and meaning. And so, as you say, when science moves outside the scope of giving us causal accounts, theories about nature, things that we can use to develop technology, then clearly there will be a competition with religion.
And this, well, then maybe this has actually brought up perhaps one final thing that I'd like to get your perspective on, which is a different scientific attempt. So not the new atheists, but the emerging field known as big history, especially as led by David Christian, whose key work is Maps of Time. And what's making me think of that is that he's very explicit that this is, quote-unquote, a modern creation myth. That he, like you're saying with Comte and others, recognises the fundamental need for a story. A story, you know. I mean, and there are a lot of critiques of the big history narrative in the sense that it doesn't, or it sort of leaves its moral implications unstated or something like that, or it's theoretically not as reflexive as it sort of needs to be or whatever. But how, 'cause that is quite a different approach to what, say, Harris is doing. But he's kind of consciously regarding as it a myth, consciously regarding the story as a myth in that non-pejorative sense. So what's your perspective? And this is presumably only going to increase over the course of the 21st century. What's your perspective on this emerging kind of idea?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting idea, and I understand the logic behind it. I think it's doomed to failure. And I think it's doomed to failure for this reason, because there's a significant difference between myth and science, and that myth is essentially ahistorical. It's not grounded in empirical facts about the world, or what we think are empirical facts about the world. So my problem with big history, I guess, insofar as it attempts to provide an alternative narrative, and as you say, in the opening pages of Maps of Time, David Christian suggests exactly this, that he's attempting to do it, to come up with an alternative creation story. It can't work, and one of the reasons is that science is an ongoing enterprise, that there are no eternal verities, as it were. The truths that science uncovers, truths is perhaps not quite the right word, but they're susceptible to constant revision. And a myth about meaning and value cannot be susceptible to constant revision in light of changing empirical evidence and changing scientific theories. So I think that project is doomed to failure precisely because it needs to free science at a particular moment in order to get that big narrative up and running. And we don't know what's going to happen in the future in terms of what claims might be made about the nature of the cosmos. We don't even know what 95% of the cosmos is made of.
We don't know how the human brain works very well.
And that, so it seems to me that the myths of the great religion stand outside those sorts of empirical claims. They can't be empirically tractable in the way, if you wanted to link a myth to science, it just seems to me to be implausible, because the truths that myths attempt to communicate are eternal and transcendental and unchanging.
I mean, that, I suppose, leads to a whole vast philosophical questions about how one then derives any kind of normative values to live by in the world without grounding them in some kind of transcendental idea like God or something else.
Well, it's a standard problem of getting the ought from the is. And I think that what's interesting is that, you know, there have been attempts to say, well, we don't believe there is a problem getting an ought from an is. But So the naturalistic fallacy issue, but I think that's a problem. So the whole idea of evolutionary ethics, that you can somehow generate ethical values simply from facts about human history, seems to me to be problematic.
Yeah, yeah. There's always got to be some choices made. Nothing's ever mathematically clear cut.
Exactly.
In that way. Well, I think talking about that further would probably require another whole discussion. So we best leave it there. So Peter Harrison, thank you very much for talking to the Religious Studies Project.
Oh, thank you, Jeff.
It's been great.
Good.
Thank you.
Well, that was a very broad-ranging interview, and it's something that we've not really touched upon. It's been implicitly...
It's been implicitly there. I think we've shied away from challenging it head-on, to be honest.
Because, precisely, we do not want to reify this sort of science-religion...
Indeed.
Conflict thing, but I think that Jack's interview there, precisely by taking a historical perspective of what those categories mean and how this conflict narrative emerged, has done exactly the sort of job that we would have wanted it to do.
Yeah, which is helpful coming from yourself as a scholar of atheism, I think. But towards the end there, Jack touches on this reified discourse of science and religion as being a sort of cornerstone of the new atheism. But, I don't study atheism, but it's something which I personally find distasteful and certainly means I've distanced myself from the new atheist rhetoric.
Absolutely, because it's so tied in with Darwinian evolution that there's just very little room for manoeuvre, I often find. And there is perhaps a reason why there's a lot of contemporary debates in scholarship on contemporary atheism about why it's quite so, let's say, white, male, highly educated, dominated. It's largely this constant rhetoric on evolution, which doesn't appeal to a wide variety.
And even the reification of the two polarities, I think, is an enormous oversimplification, although it's one which is reinforced by the particular structure of the university, and particularly the religious studies department, whatever the department is called. For instance, things like the Theosophical Society or Aleister Crowley, and these kind of esoteric or occult sources, they saw themselves as uniting science and religion, as approaching religious phenomena, religious experience, as we'll hear about in a couple of weeks from the SSSR, with scientific methodology. There was no conflict there for them, but of course they're marginalised from either of the two polarities of the discourse that we allow.
And as Daniel Hervieux-Léger points out in Religion as a Chain of Memory, there's this constant retelling within the science community of the, let's say, particularly the Galileo controversy. It's sort of retold as a foundation myth of the birth of modern science, which creates this conflict narrative that is told to the school children almost from the moment that they start taking science lessons, which then results in a reification of the idea that there is a conflict between these domains, which ignores all the stuff that was just talked about in that interview.
And it'd be interesting to read this back to our interview with Latour, Bruno Latour, summer?
It was a couple of years ago.
A couple of years ago now, right. Because that's exactly what he's talking about. The idea that religion springs from a different system of meaning that religion does is probably untrue. The terminology we use in religion is just as created as the terminology we use in science. But we prefer not to see that, because to us one is obviously true from a transcendental source, science, and the other one isn't, religion.
Because you're working within a scientific paradigm, we're implicated constantly in that discourse. And we should also mention the interview that we both did with Bron Taylor right back at the beginning on religion after Darwin, which also fits in with this as well.
Yeah.
We've worked on for a bit there because it's such a fascinating
topic.
Hot topic. But next week is our Chester material.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. So you're going to get... I don't think we've ever done this format before. Not quite like this. So you're going to get me interviewing Alana Vincent as your Monday podcast. And instead of the response will be the roundtable led by Chris with...
Elaine Graham, Wendy Dossett, Don Llewellyn, Alana Vincent, and Ethan Quillen.
So I'll be talking to Alana about religion and literature, but then we expand that out into the discussion onto religion, literature,
narrative,
reflexivity,
ethnography, the place of the author and the scholar as author.
Narrative more broadly. So it's going to be very exciting, and we hope you tune in.
For now, from the wash bar, which is becoming our default recording location. Yeah, thanks for listening.
I thought you were going to do like the BASR and Twitter, Facebook, Google Plus, iTunes. No,
I just got bored this week.
All right,
sorry.
Okay. All right. Okay, bye then.
Thanks.
Bye.